Arabic is the official language of more than 27 countries, and there are more than 400 million speakers of the language worldwide. Yet in the US, for example, less than 1% of students study Arabic. Studies have shown that those who speak a second language not only earn more, but are in higher level positions than their monolingual counterparts. And there's no shortage of studies that point to the benefits of students at the K-12 level learning a new language. The National Research Council in 2007 found that children who study a foreign language show greater cognitive development in areas such as mental flexibility, creativity, and higher order thinking skills. Qatar Foundation International inspires meaningful connections to the Arab world by creating a global community of diverse learners and educators, connecting them through effective and collaborative learning environments inside and outside the classroom. Qatar Foundation International builds bridges across cultures by increasing the number of K-12 students in the Americas and the United Kingdom with a good knowledge and understanding of Arabic language and culture, by increasing the number and quality of Arabic programs in state and public charter schools in the United States and other countries. Qatar Foundation International supports the teaching of the Arabic language through grant giving and programming activities, while increasing and professionalizing the supply of highly qualified teachers of Arabic, thus raising the visibility of a growing profession through grants, professional development, and free online resources. For more information on free teaching materials and available grants, please go to qfi.org and ispeakarabic.com. Unio is an interactive lesson delivery and assessment platform designed with teachers to promote excellence in teaching and learning. Based around shared online screens between teachers and students, Unio makes it easy to personalise learning and assess progress at a glance. Teachers can create an interactive lesson by uploading an existing PowerPoint, Word or PDF, display lessons and live annotations on all students' screens, assess understanding with self-marking quizzes, and take control of any student screen to provide targeted feedback which students can access after class. You can sign up for a free account on Unio by visiting www.uniobyharness.com. And if you're a teacher or senior leader in education, Unio would love you to get in touch via email nihal.salah, that's S-A-L-A-H, at uniobyharness.com or by Twitter at uniobyharness. Hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of the EdTech Podcast, the show about education innovation, ed and tech all around the world. My name is Sophie Bailey, and it's a pleasure to have you listening in. Before we kick off, a very exciting competition for listeners this week. The EdTech Podcast has partnered with China's number one EdTech media group in China, JMDEDU. JMDEDU's mission is to drive the advancement of education in China and globally, connecting professionals through reports and information services. They're also the group behind China's biggest EdTech event, GET, which takes place in Beijing during the 14th to the 16th of November. JMDEDU have kindly given the EdTech Podcast listeners a chance to win a free ticket to GET. All you have to do is answer the following question. Who is the Minister of Education for China? Now, if you go to our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/podcastedtech, like the page and post your answer under the question, who is the Minister of Education for China? We'll be picking one lucky winner at random. For everyone else, check out the special 40% and 20% discount codes in the event detail on our global events calendar, where details are also listed of how to redeem. Exciting! Now on to today's episode. In this podcast, we ask, how can EdTech drive school improvement? From apps that are aspiring to be the Uber of supply teaching, to cutting-edge platforms and assessment tools allowing school data to be analysed in innovative new ways, many EdTech companies are aiming to enhance teaching and learning experiences across the UK, and in doing so, transform the way that schools operate, saving them both time and money. In this recording, you'll be transported to the UK during a live recording at London EdTech Week and run by the British Educational Suppliers Association. There's also an interesting discussion on whether UK school budget restraint is pushing edtech innovation overseas. You'll hear from Andrea Carr, former managing director at Rising Stars, Naimish Gohill, founder and CEO of Show My Homework powered by Satchel, Vinnie Bantz, CEO and founder of Work2, Mark Dorling, educator and founder of the Digital Schoolhouse Project, and Tracy Goodway, head of school improvement, EES for schools. A big shout out to Unio by Harness and the Qatar Foundation International for sponsoring this week's episode. I hope you enjoy and make sure you follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter to continue the discussion. Have a great week, everyone. Yay!
My name is Abby Ross Jackson. I am the new events manager at ESA. Thank you so much to all of you for joining us tonight, particularly as it's such a wonderful, beautiful evening outside and you all voluntarily come indoors from that. So thank you to you all for being here. We're really delighted that Emran Meehan, the Department of Education, has stepped in. He is Director of Strategy and has very kindly agreed to officially open proceedings for us this evening instead.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me along to introduce. I'm not going to say very much by way of introduction, not least because the report published by BISA today showed that school leaders on the whole aren't looking to the Department for Education for guidance about how to use edtech. I think the figures in the report suggested that only about 5% of schools are looking to the department for guidance. I was a bit surprised by that figure. I was surprised it was so high. We say remarkably little as a department about education technology. I'm quite new to the department, so I feel I can still get away with saying this. But this is something that we're hoping to change. We've got a permanent secretary who unfortunately couldn't be here tonight, who's very enthusiastic about the possibilities that EdTech creates for school improvement and elsewhere. And the kind of things I think that we can usefully do, we don't want to replace any of the things that you guys do, that BISA do, or the individual providers do. But we think that, for example, there might be a role for us in terms of helping to build the evidence base for EdTech and how it contributes to school improvement, tonight's theme, or indeed how it improves to pedagogy more broadly. Equally, we think there might be a role for us in terms of thinking about data exchange across the system. I'm sure that's something that is a blockage for you guys sometimes. And there's probably a role for us as a department in helping to think about how we ease some of that problem. And then there's probably a more basic role for us working with our colleagues at the Department for Culture, Media and Sport and improving the connectedness of schools. And that's something that we're acting on as well. I think that's it for me. I'm really looking forward to listening to the debate. Over to Caroline for the panel.
Thank you very much, Emran. Thank you. So for those of you who don't know me, I'm Caroline Wright from BISA, and it's great to be here with such a fantastic group of people, having had the chance to speak to most of you before this began. But tonight's discussion, how can EdTech drive school improvement? I'm going to introduce each of the speakers individually, ask them to speak for about 5 minutes on their experience and thoughts on the topic. And then after that, I'm going to throw it open to the floor for comments and questions. We'll take a group of questions, then I'll ask the panel to answer them and we'll move on like that. So without further ado, first up, I'd like to invite Andrea Carr to talk to us. Now, for those of you who don't know, Andrea is a titan of the UK edtech industry. She founded Rising Stars back in 2002, and it just quickly moved from a niche publisher into one of the UK's largest digital and textbook publishers. It's gone from strength to strength, now got more than 30,000 schools worldwide using their products. Andrea was also awarded the Outstanding Achievement Award at ICT in Education at BET this year, which is a huge privilege and honour. So, Andrea, over to you.
Okay, so thank you very much for that introduction. Rising Stars started and we were sort of that old form of technology, the book, the printed book, which was our starting point. And thankfully, schools are still buying that low-tech solution to teaching and learning, along with the higher-tech versions, which through the last 15 years, we've explored and had some failures, but thankfully quite a lot of successes, learning a lot on the way. So I was very pleased to be invited to be on the panel this evening, not least because for me, I think it's time perhaps that we stepped back a little bit and started asking the question as to what EdTech actually means. Now, there was a session last night that the EdTech podcast ran around, is EdTech really a thing? And the more I ask myself and my colleagues and schools that I work with about EdTech, the more it becomes apparent to me that EdTech as a term tends to mean more to policymakers, to fundraisers, to incubators, than perhaps it does to those people who we are aiming to sell to support the schools. EdTech has become an all-encompassing term for so many different things. We talk about EdTech when we're talking about technology-enhanced learning, which is what many of us are involved in, so using tech in the classroom to support teaching and learning. We use EdTech to talk about when we're talking about hardware, when we're talking about connectivity, when we're talking about bandwidth, when we're talking about digital, what I call digital disciplines even, so the computing curriculum. We often frame that in the EdTech conversation. And perhaps most importantly, we talk about EdTech, we're talking about digital systems, so where systems are helping schools to manage policies, to collect, manage, use data. So EdTech has become this term which brings so much together. And I worry, and we can talk a bit about how, you know, how EdTech helps school improve, because certainly it does, but I worry that by bringing everything together and into this one term, we're actually diluting the conversation. And in order to have those really powerful discussions, perhaps we need to think about whether EdTech is the right term to be using. But as I said, huge role to play in schools improvement, and no doubt we'll hear quite a lot more about that this evening.
Thank you very much, Andrea. I already need my notepad to make notes. Moving on to our next panellist, very pleased to welcome Mark Dorling. A little bit of background about Mark. After graduating with his computing degree, he put that into practice working in primary and secondary schools. He played a leading role in developing the 2014 National Curriculum for Computing. Over to you.
Yes, good evening. Thank you for having me sit on the panel this evening. It's a real pleasure. As Caroline said, I'm actually an ICT teacher and computer science teacher. I taught for many years in both primary and in secondary school, also running ITE training for universities and academy suppliers, and also running in-service training. I founded and still support an internationally recognised project called the Digital Schoolhouse, now delivered by Yuki and powered by Sony PlayStation. I was one of the founding board members of Computing at School and played a leading role, as Caroline said, in designing and writing the national curriculum, and also leading the Department for Education Master Teachers Programme. More recently, I turned entrepreneur, or I was corrected a few weeks back, teacherpreneur, as well as trying to start studying as a student for my PhD at Queen Mary's University. I'll be honest, trying to start those two things at the same time is really not recommended, right, guys? But with my business partner, Somis Sandachandrian, we founded an online platform to combine computing resources with planning and assessment, also starting to look at training and communication with parents. We grew rapidly over 18 months, and we were soon supporting over 1,000 users without any direct marketing, all through word of mouth. So I totally agree with Beza's findings about how teachers recommend products to other teachers. Now I'm formally an EdTech teacherpreneur, having sold our business to Future Technology Resource Limited. And I'm now concentrating more on working with individual schools, chains of schools, both in this country and overseas, as well as international governments. I think it was really interesting that Andrea talked about low-tech being books and EdTech being computers. Technology in our schools today is computers, right? Well, no, not really. The pen and paper is the oldest and probably most successful form of technology in our schools that we use every day of the week. Is the technology fit for purpose, is my question. Does the technology add value to the learning and educational outcomes of our learners? Ironically, given my background, I guess, as a school leader, I really have to be convinced that an EdTech product is going to actually add value before committing investment towards it. So I have two very quick observations or comments to make in relation to the question put to me tonight. I would like to refer to the dictionary term for technology. I looked it up today, thank goodness for Google. The origins of the word technology are actually Greek, tech meaning art or craft, which I think is quite fitting given that we create beautiful products for schools and children to use. Logica means systematic treatment. So technology today involves computers. A computer is a digital device that takes inputs, it processes data, produces outputs. They automate those repetitive and boring tasks for us really quickly. I'm also convinced that in relation to the new computing curriculum, that EdTech products can drive pedagogical change, which is slow in some schools. So I'm not surprised that parental communication, assessment, and our training are the in-demand categories in schools. These are complex, time-consuming, and challenging things for schools to get right. This was the area or the space that my EdTech company worked in. We learned very quickly that technology in schools can be complex and ineffective. With this in mind, we need to ensure that EdTech actually makes life easier for our teachers, not just adding to their everyday to-do list. We need to design EdTech that teachers actually want and, more importantly, need. And therefore, we need to see more teacherpreneurs entering into this space. We need to ensure that the EdTech saves time, that teachers can do what they do best, and that's teach, right, and be in front of children. We need to improve the learning experiences for our children and educational outcomes. We need to design EdTech products with teachers for teachers. Test it with children if it's for children and combine creativity and research. But most importantly, we need to drive efficiency savings in our schools so that we can spend that money on having teachers in classrooms with our kids, because that's what schools are all about. I'm particularly glad to hear that 62% of primary schools and 85% of secondary schools didn't want another government body making top-down decisions. One size doesn't fit all, because every school has different challenges, as does every region in the country. However, we do need to support our schools with their investments to maximise the outcomes for learners. Having been an EdTech provider, I can see why only 10% of primary schools and 11% of secondary schools have sufficient information to make informed decisions about what EdTech they buy. We need to educate schools not to simply follow the crowd, but still value the recommendations they receive from their colleagues. I feel that what we need to do as an industry is move the conversation on, as Andrea said, take a step back and actually make an efficacy pledge. A pledge to actually give the schools the information they need quickly and efficiently so they can actually make the decisions that support learner outcomes. We need to stop hard selling to them at different events, telling them that this product is going to solve all their problems when we know that it's not. And actually, we still haven't asked them the question, what is the problem that you've got in the first place? And we need to encourage schools to trial products and not just to jump in at the deep end. EdTech can support and automate repetitive tasks performed by teachers, for example, assessment. But we all see different types of inefficiencies in our schools. I particularly like the Uber-style app for supply teaching because it cuts out the middleman, it puts money back into the pockets of hardworking teachers, and it also maintains or preserves cash-strapped schools.
Our next guest is Tracy Goodaway. Tracy leads the education strand of School Effectiveness Plus at EES for Schools, and that's a school improvement system which is based on the 25 characteristics of high-performing schools. Tracy's worked within the school improvement team for a number of years, leading and managing large-scale projects, and has also been a consultant advisor and previously worked at the DfE advising them as a school standards advisor. So over to you, Tracy.
Thank you for having me here. As has just been said, my background is actually in teaching, school leadership, was a head teacher, have had a variety of roles for 30 plus years in school improvement, essentially. Currently working as the head of school effectiveness in EES for Schools, which is the school improvement delivery arm of Essex County Council, basically. So we're publicly owned, but we trade nationally as well. When I was asked to sort of say, give a few thoughts about EdTech and how it can or does support school improvement, I did what I normally does, which is badger my friends and say to them, okay, so what's your perception of EdTech at the moment and how it supports school improvement? You can tell I have some exciting conversations at dinner parties, can't you? So what I got back, and it's interesting to relate to Mark's comment about what is the definition of EdTech, in terms of what I got back was very much my colleagues who are head teachers, school leaders, etc., saying they focused on things like resources immediately, the support, engagement in teaching and learning in the classroom. That was the big theme that came out from them. The second one were things that supported generic pedagogical approaches, such as using video, things like dance, PE. And the third strand was actually things that support teachers where their own subject knowledge might be weaker. So particularly in things like music and dance, PE, things like that. So things that could actually support, and computing and ICT obviously came through as well. I think they, it very much also, their responses echoed what was said in today's report about where do they get their advice from. And it was very much about co-practitioner recommendation, came through very strongly. And I didn't even know at that point when I asked the question what the report was going to say today. And I think this notion of supporting schools to make, and the phrase that was used is evidence-based decisions, is at the heart of what we need to be looking at. And in a sense, it links to my second theme, which is what do we think EdTech can do more for schools? And I think it's about helping them make evidence-based decisions about what they need to focus on in terms of school improvement at any given time. Certainly within ES for Schools, that's the area that's exercising us at the moment. How do we use technology, not for schools to necessarily just access resources in the classroom, but to access tools that help them work in school self-evaluation, bring together stakeholder views to be able to evaluate their school. Hence, we built the framework of what we call the 25 characteristics of high-performing schools to enable that. But basically, using technology to bring together the process of analysis of the school situation so that the focus can then be placed on development. And in terms of development, how do we use technology to really help schools become self-improving? And that may be in a collaborative sense in a MAT as well, but also work in a school-led, school-to-school support context. How do schools find out the relative strengths and areas for development for other schools with whom they might be able to engage through technology or through good old-fashioned professional development as well? So it's actually about enabling schools to look at those wider school improvement agendas using educational technology.
Our next guest and panellist, Vinnie Bantz, the founder and CEO of Work2, which is the Uber type app we've been talking about that Mark mentioned. Vinnie was a secondary school teacher for 5 years, working in some really disadvantaged areas, including schools in Barking and Dagenham and other tough working environments. She left teaching to look at a career in EdTech and founded Work2, which is an online solution to help solve some of the recruitment crisis that we currently find ourselves in the school system. Alongside that, Vinnie also volunteers as a primary school governor and is a STEM ambassador for STEMnet. So over to you, Vinnie.
So as mentioned, I'm a former teacher. So I started my career as a secondary school teacher in a high school. Started teaching citizenship in the first year. Second year was religious education. Third year was history. By the time I left secondary school teaching in the sixth year, I was teaching about 7 different subjects. What went wrong? Well, the school just did not have enough teachers to fill those gaps. So whenever I did have a few hours off, I was told to go into the other classroom, pick up a textbook, pretty much learn it a few hours before I was supposed to deliver a lesson. Did I have time to implement technology? Not really. I tried my best. We tried to experiment as much as we could, but we just did not have the resources as a school. So that's my experience as a teacher. As a governor, technology, we're bombarded with companies that want to sell you a product. I've been to the BET show many, many years consecutively, and as a governor, trying to figure out what products would work for our children. Again, I have no evidence whether this would be a good product or not. And to be honest, in the end, the best evidence is a nearby school that has used a product and has told us it's very effective with their children. That is what is most likely for us to purchase that product. I founded an EdTech platform after being a teacher and still being a governor. This has been amazing because I'm actually understanding from a teacher's and a governor's point of view what products we should build. There's many EdTech companies I've met in the last couple of years whilst working in the EdTech industry that don't talk to teachers, that don't talk to schools when building products. They build something, present it to teachers, and then they're surprised why schools aren't buying it and why teachers do not use it. That is not how it works. I think a lot of companies are realizing this now, which is amazing. And I think there's a lot of teachers who are founding companies, which is even better. I think the key thing for EdTech, any EdTech company, is to actually understand what problem you're trying to solve firstly. I recently met a company that actually spent 3 months founding the company, sitting in classrooms across 3 schools, not even thinking about what product they were going to make. But every day they came across problems that teachers faced. And by the end of the 3 months, they had so many ideas of what products to make. And that is the best way to make a product. I absolutely admire that company. I think going ahead, there needs to be a great collaboration between edtech companies, teachers, as well as schools. I've heard a lot of complaints of edtech companies finding it very hard to access teacher time. I've heard immensely how schools are saying, we never get a chance to pilot these programs or these companies or their products. They just come here and they expect us to pay thousands sometimes for a product. I don't even know if it will work. And it has to be a collaborative effort, in my opinion, of edtech companies, teachers, and schools coming together to create the most effective products for those children and those teachers.
Thank you. That's really helpful. Naimish doesn't really need an introduction, but I will, for those of you who don't know him. Naimish Gohil, founder and CEO of Satchel, which the better-known brand of Show My Homework, which you've undoubtedly heard from, which he set up after working as a secondary school teacher in a London secondary school with an idea of how to kind of help parents and schools communicate over homework. It's gone phenomenally well. And over to you, Naimish. Talk more about it.
Thanks, Caroline. And thanks, Patrick and Bisa, for giving me the opportunity to come and share some thoughts. Yeah, I guess, you know, my story started back in the classroom, really from a pain point that I experienced. You know, homework hasn't changed for over 100 years. And it was something that I had to figure out being a senior leader in a school with a school-wide responsibility for kind of ICT across the curriculum and infrastructure. And I guess one of the things that I've learned is I think it's absolutely critical to solve a problem. I think Vinny hit the nail on the head that having done this now for like 5.5 years now and working with a ton of schools, I think that's been critical. When you talk to teachers, being able to solve a problem, you can't solve all their problems, but being specific and focused on solving problems that they can resonate with and that you can talk to about in teacher language really helps you get their attention. So I think that's been a big thing for us. What I've seen over the last 5.5 years is we've seen an explosion of kind of edtech technologies, apps, websites, all sorts over the last 5 years. And that's created a lot of innovation, but it's also created a lot of noise. And again, if going back when I was in school, we had central procurement. We had technology procured at the local authority level. We had learning platforms being pushed down from like Hammersmith and Fulham, and it was pushed down onto the schools that I worked in. And there's many, many benefits of doing that. But there was, in my mind, there was many, many reasons why that wasn't as successful at scale as it probably could have been. And one of the reasons is I don't believe people really thought about what it's like to be a teacher, what it's like to be in the trenches. And often I felt it was a checkbox exercise in terms of what should we include in this RFP? Let's tick it all off and let's hope these teachers will use it. When the reality is when they're after school sitting on a, you know, doing an hour's training session, it's just not going to happen. I always viewed the ecosystem in a school like a bell curve. You've got kind of 10% of teachers who are like bouncing up and down, just joined the profession, really excited. You've got the other 10% are really tech savvy, really comfortable with technology. But you've really got that middle, and it's really about making technology work for those 80% in the middle. There's a famous saying for those teachers here, you know, consistency leads to outstanding outcomes, whether that's with homework, behavior, school vision. And it's about giving that consistent experience, regardless of whether students walk in from lesson one to lesson two to lesson three. I was really interested in the fact that from the survey, there are a lot of schools are saying, or the teachers saying, they don't need another body to give recommendations. I actually have a different view on that. I think there's lots and lots of value in having someone that can provide with authority, with clarity, what the school vision in terms of the IT plan should look like. Because I think there's differences in terms of edtech solutions, whether it's at the class level or whether it's at the school-wide level. And what I see at the moment, as we work in a lot of schools, there's lots of overlap in feature sets from school to school to school. There's lots of mobility because of this, you know, retention, recruitment problem. So you end up with schools buying several pieces of technology where you've got multiple renewal cycles, multiple providers, and where there's a deficiency in terms of having too many products that do too many things. When if you had, like we said about the CPD in place, more support, you don't have to keep buying a new piece of technology just because the member of staff that's just joined the school hasn't used what's already in the existing school and they're championing another tool. So there's definitely pros and cons. And just to finish off, I'm super bullish on the future of technology in education, especially in terms of how can we help teachers do what they go into the profession to do, which is teach. How can we remove the barriers? How can we remove those obstacles? Because that's fundamentally, I believe, one of the reasons why we have people leave the profession is they wake up one morning and they're thinking, I'm doing all these things, and number 9 or number 10 on my list is the teaching part. And how can we always make that the number one thing? So I'll stop there. I could talk about this all day. Thanks.
No, thank you very much. I'm going to throw it open to the floor now. I'm sure there are lots of questions. I'll take sort of perhaps groups of 3 or 4 questions at a time, and it will test my memory, and then ask for some comments. Terry.
Terry Friedman. I run a website called ICT and Computing and Education. I just wanted to pick up on the thing about teachers learning from each other and having recommendations from each other. And one of the things I find, and this is kind of an indication of my age, I suppose, is that we always seem to forget history. And I just wondered if the panel thinks there's any value in someone convening a research project to find out what worked and what didn't work in other schemes, such as, for example, I'm going back a little way, I may have got the name wrong, but something called the Teacher Resource Exchange, I think it was, run by what was called BECTA. There was, or maybe still is, an SSAT scheme where schools can help each other. There's the Times Education Supplement, which still is a massive teacher resource where people recommend stuff to each other. There's a scheme in the USA, the name of which escapes me. There are recommendations based on research from an organisation called MirandaNet and one from ITI. So there's all this expertise, and even though schools might say they don't want an overarching body, the people who worked in those bodies are still around, unless they've died. But just because the body disappeared doesn't necessarily mean the people have. So all I'm saying is there's a lot of expertise, even in this room, that people could draw on before making the same mistakes again. And I just wondered if the panel thought there was any mileage in that. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you. John Galloway. Mainly I work for Tower Hamlets as advisory teacher for ICT, SEN and inclusion. And in a way, this follows on from what Terry was saying. Several people have spoken about the need for evidence-based practice. But I wondered about evidence-based products and whether providers actually do their research about learning, teaching and learning. Somebody sent me a link about a product, and I'm very impressed with the research that they've done and the thinking. And my other interest, the ICT, SEN inclusion interest, I try to talk to providers about universal design for learning and the idea of trying to create products that are as inclusive as possible by thinking about who's going to use them and how you can remove barriers to learning. So it's things like that. Is there's the need for providers to also do their homework and think about making their products both up to date in terms of what the research says about learning, but also in terms of being inclusive and engaging as many learners as possible through the resource they're providing.
Thank you. And back to Patrick, please.
Patrick from BISA. My question's for Vinny, because I think Work2 must be the most talked about EdTech app at the moment. My question really is, what are the main obstacles you're facing in rolling that out at the moment? It makes so much intuitive sense. Everyone's talking about it. What's preventing you from scaling up in the way that really you should be doing at the moment? What are the big challenges you're facing?
Okay, thank you. I'll take one more question. G had a question, then we'll get some answers.
Hi, G from Plum Innovations. How would you define between learning technology and the teaching technology? And if a school have to invest in one, which one should they go for? Thank you.
Right. Let's take the first two questions, sort of rolling them up into one first. So we've got a bit of a question about what about sharing research, best practice, just learning from history before we move on? How can we talk about what works? And then in terms of what works, talked about evidence-based practice, but what about evidence-based products? Anyone like to talk about that?
So I think this is a really important question, actually. Evidence-based product design. I think it was something that we were very aware of when we started to design our product. And starting a PhD and looking at the evidence and the research out there, I suddenly realised that research is very difficult in education. You can only prove really something that doesn't work. You can never categorically say it does work. I think that it's very risky for
organisations to go down that route, because if they've spent a lot of time and effort trying to prove something works and then it doesn't work, what then? Having said that, I think that we do need more of it. You know, we can't just keep having, you know, bright ideas and selling snake oil to schools. There's got to be outcomes for learners. We've got to invest more in that. Answering Terry's first question about what can we learn moving forwards from the past, some of us, and I can see faces around the room that have been involved in this, have actually been trying to do this for the last few months. A few emails here and there. I've met somebody tonight who I've talked to who, you know, said they were doing something very similar. We've been looking at an efficacy rubric, the idea that companies would all sign up to buy for certain information, and then when schools make decisions about products, they could actually base it on evaluating the teaching pedagogy and the learning resources, going back to your question, John, the learning theories that are behind them. But it's difficult, right? Because it's just groups of individuals at the moment all trying, who all say the same thing, who all want to do the same thing, because none of us are in ed tech to get rich, right? We're in it because we passionately believe in children and education and their future. But we do need a body, or actually more importantly, a group of bodies to come together, like BISA, maybe other organisations that you mentioned, like SSAT, TESS, ITI, MirandaNet and co., to actually, you know, step up and set up working groups and actually try and support schools to make good decisions. Because I think, as somebody said on the panel, schools are so massively overstretched at the moment. And what we really want them to do is focus on teaching and learning and give them the information they need to make informed decisions.
Thank you, Mark. Andrea, so how do you go about kind of efficacy in terms of your products?
Well, we have developed a process whereby we have partner schools with whom we trial over months, in some cases years, in terms of assessment, particularly around assessment structures. But it's hard. As a business, particularly if you're a small growing business, investment in trialing product can be highly damaging to your commercial models. It takes time. You know, small businesses, it's all about cash flow. Waiting for results from trials can cause you real problems. You know, as Mark said, you know, and what if the results don't give you the answers you want? Then what? It's time consuming and it's costly. So we need to find a better way of evaluating our products so that small and medium-sized businesses in particular can buy into it. And that's creating frameworks for efficacy. I mean, there's been some really interesting stuff done by Nesta around experimental testing, being a bit more fleet of foot in terms of how you evaluate effectiveness. Educate, which is the UCL project, which was launched at BET, again, with Nesta and with BISA's support, you know, looking at how evaluations can be done, but in the contexts of smaller businesses and how smaller businesses are working with education. I think it's worth saying that I actually think the Department for Education does have a role to play. At this time of year, schools all over the country are going to be running their school improvement planning process. So they'll be sitting down and thinking about what their school improvement plan looks like for 2017-18, the academic year from September. It's a crucial bit of work that every school will be doing it, I would say, around about this time and finalising it through September. What are the key things on those school improvement plans that we see across the school sector? You know, I think there's something to be done about bringing together all of that, identifying what are those things that are rising to the top, what are those key issues for schools, you know, and there will be things like parental engagement, behaviour management. Yes, of course, it's going to be about attainment and progress, filling the gaps. You know, we probably know, but do we really know what the top five things are? And I would suggest that as a department, there's a useful piece of work to do there. What are those common issues? And then we can start having meaningful conversations together about what are the pieces of software, the technologies that are actually making a difference, and how do we share that more widely?
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to bring in Tracy at this point, actually. I mean, what's your advice to schools when you're talking to them about what's worked, where's the evidence base, what kind of research can they draw on? Is it such a fragmented system as we're hearing about? And what do you say?
I think I absolutely agree with you that there have been lots of attempts to say, let's put together what works well frameworks and things like that. And I think there is a big role for, we've used the phrase already, stepping back and actually saying, let's go back to the good old, you know, meta-analysis in terms of saying, let's throw it all into the melting pot and see what we can filter out of it, which is certainly the approach that we have tried to take. is to take on board that, and somebody's got to take a role in that, which kind of leads to the second point, picking up on what you were just saying, in terms of almost a coordinating agency or set of partnerships or something, where actually we can say, what are those key themes and trends that we are all independently trying to respond to at the moment? And I think it is absolutely right to say then, I mean, we were lucky in working with ES for Schools in developing the school effectiveness products that we've just done, in that we had support from the local authority as a body in that particular case to commission some of the work that went into our product development, because there was a particular issue that had been identified. So I think that notion of being able to pull together what are those themes and strands in school improvement and find some way of forming partnerships rather than just competitions around how we might address those, and whether there do need to be some partnerships of agencies or organising bodies to do that, to stop us running off down lots of parallel tracks.
Just moving on to Patrick's question, which was originally to Vinnie, but actually I'd like to ask Vinnie, Naimish and Andrea just to give your views. So what were the main obstacles in your companies to roll out and scale up, starting with Vinnie?
I'd probably say there's two main issues. The first one was when we came up with the idea and we went to the initial schools, and still this happens to this day, massive mindset change. I spoke to one head teacher who has been a head teacher for over 30 years, adamant that there was no other way but recruitment agencies. Yet I've been to other schools where there's a head teacher who's 35 years old and absolutely is excited about the prospect of using an app to book a teacher. So across the board, if you go even out of London, you speak to many, many head teachers, it's a huge mindset change, just in my own app, WorkTwo. But I'm kind of imagining the same mindset change is across the board. So I'd love to hear from Naimish as well about what he thought. And even Rising Stars, they must have faced the same problem. The second main issue I think we're having at the moment is we're speaking to a lot of investors who want a quick return. And that's something I've realized working in EdTech for a very short time doesn't happen, to the point where we're actually speaking to investors in America who are more keen to invest in us than local investors. And that is quite a problem for running a UK-based company. I don't want investors, and it's possibly one of the last things we want as a company, to have American-based investors. So the big challenge for us at the moment is getting local investors on board and telling them, you're not going to get a massive return with EdTech, but it's an investment for life. Supply teaching, as you mentioned, is a £1.3 billion industry, but you won't get it as an angel investor in the next 3-4 years. That is something that is quite hard for the EdTech industry as a whole, I think.
So I guess the way we scaled up was really making sure that we got outside of the office, because there was no central procurement. I would be, you know, on the train from Southend to Inverness. And that's what we made a conscious effort to do, to physically get outside of our office and go to trade shows, go and visit schools. Whenever I talk to EdTech companies, that's the one piece of advice I would give. Make sure you get outside of your office and physically go and see schools, even though it may be expensive. But in the early days, building brand, building trust, building relationships is really the thing that will stay true over time. That will be the big differentiator. I see technology today becoming almost a commodity. It's so easy to develop. But doing it at scale, it's significantly harder. So what will really differentiate and give you that a sustainable business is those relationships and that brand in the sector. But it means, as Vinny said, there's no silver bullet. You can't do it to get rich. It's very, very hard, and you need a long-term view. Everyone in my business, we are full-time employees. We physically go out to do training. We provide customer support, customer success. It's not just, here's a piece of software, then go and do what you want with it. It's about being there as a partner, and that's expensive. You've got to realize that right from the outset when you're thinking about kind of your customer acquisition cost. So you think about, actually, this customer, it's all about the lifetime value. How long do I have this customer? And I'm willing to spend X amount up front to make sure that they stay with us, even through thick and thin, but they trust us. John made a good point around, you know, accessibility and inclusion and stuff. I think we as a company can definitely do so much better to do that. We try and do things around making things accessible offline and on different devices and language preferences. But I think What I'd love to see the DfE do or government is really force providers to make sure that their software is accessible from day one. For those companies that are really serious about doing something, even for us, right, it will force us, like Andrea touched, there's so many other constraints and so many other challenges, but having those sort of guidelines from day one really gets you to think about kind of, you know, inclusion for everyone. And I think that's a really valid point. And then just around, the gentleman over there, the question around if you had to choose a learning tool versus a kind of a teaching tool, it's kind of really difficult to answer that. I always believe it all starts with the teacher. If you can make their life easier, better, they can make a real impact on those 25, 30 kids in the classroom. That's the teacher in me, so I'm always going to back that.
Selling anything, let's not ignore this fact, selling anything to a school right now is really difficult, even if it's a $4.99 revision book. You know, trying to sell a £600 subscription for 1 year is so hard. I don't think there's anybody out there that's finding it easy. If they are, they're probably not telling you the truth. So we've always come at it that whatever we create, it's absolutely needs-based. And I'm repeating what's already been said, but absolutely is what's going to be needed in the classroom or needed by the school that's really going to make a difference. So yes, knowing the school's improvement plan, the detail of it, you need to. If you don't, you're not going to have a valuable conversation. I always used to say to my team, you need to have three things in your mind before you even start creating that product. Three messages, three hooks. What are you going to say? If you've got that teacher standing in front of you, you tell them three things. The first thing you tell them, they're going to be saying, actually, I'm really interested in that product. By the time you give them the second, they're saying, do you know what? I'm really going to need it. And by the third, they've got their checkbook out and they don't even know what it is yet. You know, that's a really good discipline. If you've got your three key sales hooks to help you define your product. And that was a process that we always went through and we still go through to ensure that we're creating the right thing. But it's not easy. Long-term trialing. I mean, we've just not long ago created something and we gave it away free for a year because we felt it was an appropriate way of getting the message out, getting as many schools as possible trialing it so that when we came to get feedback, get some evidence, we'd have enough and we'd have enough schools wanting to actually buy for a second year. So, you know, these kind of initiatives are becoming increasingly important.
Just before we move on to the next set of questions, actually just Tracy and Mark, out of the choice, learning technology and teaching technology, which one would you go for and why?
This is going to sound like a cop-out, but I will say it anyway. I think it's about teacher tools that enable independent learning for pupils and students. So actually, I don't see the two as necessarily distinct.
Thank you. Thank you. Right, next round of questions.
Sorry, hi, this is G again. It's a question for Mark. You have been helping CAS to design the computing curriculum. And my question is, when the new curriculum started, all the schools are talking about coding. So why school didn't start it with digital literacy? Or, you know, because not every child is going to become a coder, but they're all going to work in a digital environment in the future. So why school didn't start with digital learning first, but straight into the coding? Thank you.
Hello, my name's Margaret and I'm a teacher and an educational writer. If you have ideas about something that you think schools would be interested in, where does one go to with that idea?
Okay, let's take those two. So Mark, why start with coding rather than the wider computing?
Thanks for that question, right? Why does everyone start with coding? I think the new computing curriculum was obviously a sizable shift in policy. I think it's important to note that there are three strands of the computing curriculum, which was computer science, IT and digital literacy. What I would have known as IT and digital literacy is what was ICT, right? I think that ministers, thank you very much for obviously supporting the new computing curriculum and bringing computer science into the curriculum, did tend to focus on the coding element. And I think that the press and the media probably weren't helpful by saying everyone's become a coder. My personal view is that we, in the same way we live in a physical world, we learn physics. In the same way we learn live in a chemical world, we learn, learn chemistry, we learn modern foreign languages because, hey, the world's getting smaller and we need to communicate and understand one another's cultures. In the same way, we live in an increasingly digital world, so it's important our learners understand the concepts and the principles that underpin that technology. Why is that important? Well, if you've got two children who grow up and they become entrepreneurs like us, and one child doesn't understand that these two bits of software won't ever work together because they're built on different concepts and principles, then they're going to immediately be at a disadvantage. Secondly, I think that I've always seen digital literacy as something that's about responsibility, you know, digital responsibility, but also functional skills. And I think that the term digital literacy isn't clearly defined enough. But for me, the new computing curriculum does embody that digital literacy and starting with that first, because computing's origins are based on philosophy and asking the what-if question and thinking about the impact of that technology on society before doing anything. So I really like Miles Berry's term that he says that computer science is the foundations of the subject, information technology is the application of the subject, and digital literacy is the implications of the subject. So with all the schools I work with and all the teaching I've ever done, I've always started with digital literacy first, looking at teaching techniques like philosophy for children, and then using that as the vehicle to engage and inspire. Because if we think about what engages people, marketing methodology, people buy why, not what, as Andrea said. And if we compare companies that do it really well to those that don't, if we look at Apple, for example, 30-second advert, for 27 seconds they show you rich, happy people that live in California who don't have spots, who have perfect children, who go rock climbing every weekend, oh, and they drive a Volvo. Well, apart from the Volvo, who wants that lifestyle? Well, I do. You know, it just so happens, click, click, here's an Apple, and the product's an Apple, you know, tablet. If you compare that to Microsoft, same advert, but 27 seconds they show you what the product is, 2 seconds how to use it. And for 1 second, they put the tablet over their heads and run for a fountain. So now I know that that tablet makes an awesome umbrella. And I think the same goes in our classrooms, right? We have to inspire children. Three learning objectives are not inspiring. We have to start with why, not what.
Yeah, I would say that the absence of reference to the use of technology across teaching and learning in the National Curriculum 2014 was an absolute travesty. There were a number of us, many of us actually, maybe one or two people in this room, who were invited to give views as when the national curriculum was being developed. And we went quite a long way to having a phrase around the appropriate use of technology to support teaching and learning in the overarching aims of the national curriculum. At the 11th hour, ministers, whose names I'm sure you can imagine, stripped that out. It was taken out. Obviously, the computing curriculum was there, and that was deemed to be enough. But of course, those of us close enough to all this know that the two things actually are quite different. So, you know, if anything, you know, nothing necessarily stays the same, but I would suggest that the national curriculum could be adapted further and really should be adapted to include reference to the appropriate and very valuable use of technology for teaching and learning.
Vinny, I'd like to come to you on the Margaret's question about, well, when you've got an idea, where do you go? How do you, you've got a great idea? How do you go to schools? Who do you go to? Who do you choose first?
I would say the most important thing is surround yourself by similar people, people who've got ideas. So attend meetups, attend EdTech networking events. You'll find the room is full of people with ideas. Also, I found as starting at Worktu, we got a lot of advice and a lot of help from an accelerator we started at called Bethnal Green Ventures. They're a social impact accelerator. But what we found initially, we actually had a conversation with them and we said, well, this is what we're doing. What do we actually need to do, or how far do we actually need to be to enroll in an accelerator like this? And again, they provided us similar advice. Go network, go to meetups, think about what product you'd like to build. And to be honest, the amount of companies that were in this accelerator who literally just had an idea and nothing else, it's astounding. So you don't need a business plan for these accelerators. They want to see the founders, they want to see the vision and the product that you would envisage that you would create. So yeah, I would say the key thing is a social circle. Don't hang around with your friends for a while. Just go to meetups, go to the pub afterwards. That's the most important bit. And that's when the real conversations happen. And that's when you actually get inspired to do the project that you want to, or start the company that you want to.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would just say, like Vinny mentioned, there's another really cool accelerator called Emerge in London. But there's also organisations like BISA. There's a lot of fantastic entrepreneurs who have been through various cycles. Go and talk to them. They will help you. I've got a great short story to share, but there's a CEO called Richard Marrott from Wiz Education. Before I started my business, I was Googling and his name came up and I called his office up and I spoke to the receptionist and I just said, can I speak to Richard? And they go, "Who?" You know, they asked who I was. I said, I'm teaching at the moment. You guys seem successful. Can I pick Richard's brain? And then a week later, he got back to me and said, yeah, just come down. Come and see me at my office in Paddington. And I spent an hour with him. And we became good friends. And I learned a ton every time I would meet him. And I would just check in with him every kind of 3-4 months. And he's seen our business grow from kind of nothing to kind of where we are today. But there's a lot of really kind people in this space. So go and pick their brains. You know, and they all have their contact details on their websites. If they don't, that's worrying. But do that, yeah.
Thank you. And Tracy, from the opposite perspective, when schools, you're advising schools, what do you tell them to do in terms of how do they find out about products, services, companies? What would your advice be to them?
I think it's what we've said so far. Look for people that have got accreditations, that have got a history, that have got, coming back to the BISA code of practice and things like that, that actually go out there and seek validation for their products. I think more than anything adds weight to that personal testimonial side of things. The other thing I'd like to just briefly add to you as well around that one is, as well, you were saying, where do you go if you've got an idea? I think one of the one of my roles in school effectiveness is to horizon scan and say, what is the latest thing that's out there that people need? I think if you can demonstrate as well, canvas the fact that there is a need and that there is a market, then, you know, you can start approaching school effectiveness providers and saying, you know, are there partnerships out there as well that you could look at in terms of realising ideas? So there's that space as well.
Thank you. Right, next round of questions.
Hiya. My name is Yanis. I used to be a teacher and now I'm a founder of Federio. My question is about looking beyond the UK, looking beyond Britain. Mm. We're talking about making sure our products work and they are effective. Do you think that school efficacy or efficiency is something that can be exported elsewhere easily? And what are the core things to keep in mind when looking at an international market rather than just the British one?
Evening, I'm Seb from Titus Learning. That fits in quite nicely with my question. So we had the EdTech Special Interest Group meeting today and a lot of the discussion was around the state of the market and a lot of companies moving into international schools. Some were saying that they were plateauing or growing slower in the UK. And the question that came out of it was really, could the UK market suffer because companies are looking overseas, and could the UK miss out on some of the innovation because companies are going international first?
Hi, I'm Diana Summers from Language Magnet, fledgling business. So from Birmingham, I'm just wondering, how do you find the region shaping up? Because it seems that there's a lot of concentration of ed tech in London, things taking off in London. And so I'm wondering what your experience is of more regional developments.
Brilliant. Right. Well, I think they're three nice, meaty questions to take. So first two about international. Can we export efficacy? Will our UK strength decline internationally if we don't continue investing? And what do you find in the regions outside London town?
We definitely believe as a business that we have to think outside of the UK. The market's just not big enough to do something at substantial scale. And we've been focusing on international markets, so things like the Middle East. And we focus on the Middle East because it's a confined area, time zone isn't massive. A lot of the expats there are senior leaders from the schools within the UK. And really, the British education system has a really, really strong brand globally. So when I think about going into new markets, you know, you can't conquer China or you can't conquer Middle East in day one, but be really, really focused on kind of who your customer segment is. Really, really focused. So if you're looking at the UAE, there's 100 international schools in that region, tops. So then you can really focus in on those schools. But yes, so if you have limited resource, be really, really focused. But I definitely believe the British education system is a fantastic brand globally. And that's something that we hear when we talk to schools out there.
we're just about getting by with the UK at the moment. Super tiny compared to these guys. I recently went to Australia and I met a few edtech companies, and surprisingly, big country, very small edtech space. But what they're finding is a lot of companies from the UK are coming over to Australia, and similar reasons. It's the same kind of setup, and it's a natural space for UK companies to go to. Same with Australian companies, they are coming over here. What you mentioned, it's going to be very harmful for us in the next few years if a lot of edtech companies get business from abroad very easily compared to UK schools. And I think that is what's happening. I've spoken to a few companies and they just find it easier to sell products to international schools who do have a higher budget, who do have that excess bit of money that they can trial a product for 3 to 6 months and pay thousands of pounds for it compared to a state school in the UK. So I think that is a huge issue that we do need to tackle in some way.
I was just thinking about China, actually, because interestingly enough, we've got strong links with China and are now working with them with some of our products. And I think, as was said earlier, this notion that England has a strong brand for education is very prominent. And the things that we learned around China is they got excited about using technology, but wanted the frameworks that they value in England around accountability, criterion-based assessment, was the second one. And the third was increasingly wanting to face the challenges of having to develop learner-centered values in their teaching and to actually open up those kind of interactive pedagogies as well. So those were the areas that we found we were having discussions with in that particular part of the world.
Thank you. Mark?
Other parts of the world do have higher budgets for edtech. We actually started to talk to international schools in both the Middle East and in Asia. What we noticed, particularly in the Middle East, was that the product has to be priced accordingly, both in terms of us being able to support them because of time zone differences, but more importantly, because we were trying to price our product really low for the UK schools, so it was really affordable, we then had questions about why was the price so low? And then you get into discussions, well, why is your price so low in the UK, but then you're charging us more, and it gets complicated, so we didn't go there. And we just felt like it was detracting from our primary focus, which was to learn, as Andrea said, about the product and then get lots of feedback from schools about how we can make it really good. A couple of the international schools we'd actually dealt with did actually have efficacy processes. They wanted long-term relationships, and that required them to go for a process of evaluation. Usually they wanted a free evaluation, and that would have required us to do a lot of upfront investment in the relationship in terms of going out there to do the training, to be able to support, etc., etc. And then we realized the process would be, although it could be very profitable, it would be very slow and require lots of patience and a much bigger budget. And we were bootstrapping our startup. So we actually decided to focus on the UK market. But actually for us, because the UK market is doing a lot of those things that you mentioned in terms of learner-centered learning, et cetera, frameworks, accountability, et cetera, that was our core market for really understanding education and whether our product would work in other countries. So I'd say to companies, don't lose sight of this country and the amazing kind of test base you have on your doorstep with schools that already understand what you're trying to do, and focus on an international market and become very short-sighted because there's money and a big pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Yeah, just briefly on international. So my experience would suggest that if you're creating curriculum-type content, this is a generalisation, but it's hard to sell it internationally because curriculums vary so much. So you have to be prepared to adapt what you're doing, work with partners to make it work, but it's hard. If you're creating or using technology around digital systems, so systems management, data management, the plumbing of a school, then you're far more likely to be able to find market internationally, my experience. In terms of regional around the UK, I can honestly say from our perspective, we've never found it any different between north, south, east, west. Luckily, we've found schools wanting to take what we do all four corners. But I think you're right, with technology, so much of the investment and the focus is here. And actually, the Educate programme that I mentioned earlier that was just launched is just based in London, and I found that a shame.
You're talking about kind of the global brand of UK education, and actually, I'm just really pleased. We've got Yaki, Avi and Cecilia here from the joint UK-Israeli EdTech Task Force.
And I think I might come to you guys in a second, but some of the reasons why people partner with the UK on issues is because precisely because of our strong reputation. And I think that's very much based on the trust in the UK education system and quality, the quality of our products. And I think it's pretty obvious that actually efficacy fits in there and could very easily be, you know, if you're talking about trust, we're talking about quality, well, evidence-based efficacy, it's a natural progression. So I think as we develop there, it's a natural export area. From our BISA research with our members, we know that the UK market is so tough for schools at the moment. That's a factor that's also helping encourage UK companies export, but it's also the strong brand. We're seeing our members from now, currently around 23%, massive generalisation, obviously. Some companies will be entirely UK-based. Some will have more than 50% of their sales internationally, but the average will be 23% of sales going through international markets. Our members are telling us they're expecting that to move up to 40% by 2020. And I think that's a direct correlation with the interest we see internationally in our strong products. So it's kind of vital that we do sort of invest in the UK so that we can continue to keep up that strong track record. I am pleased, though, sort of final point from me, that actually we have got an open door with the Department for International Trade. Dr. Liam Fox, who returned as the International Trade Secretary, myself and colleague Patrick met him literally within 3 weeks of him being appointed. And his comment to us was he thinks the education export market is one of the two strong service sectors, if you like, that we need to do more to support in the UK, legal services and education exports. And to be fair to him, he has been true to his word. And we are continuing to get strong grant support for our UK small companies to go out to new international markets. So that's something that we are working on as we move on. But Arvi, tell us, why do you like working with the UK? What are our strengths?
Thank you, Caroline. We are, as an Israeli innovation center, try from day one to find the global partnerships, because Israel is too small market and we have a very dynamic and active ecosystem. And the UK is a perfect match because from the one hand, it's pretty close. It's not like traveling to the States. It's also, in a way, a market that, although it's a pretty big market, it's not in the same kind of ecosystem that you can see in the US. We see lots of infrastructure that is still lacking some of the pieces, and we are facing the same kind of challenges. And we find like we are, in a way, overcome our loneliness as a very small, but with a very big ambitions globally, we find lots of similarities here to the market, and so for us it's let's say the initial bridge going outside Israel is through the UK ecosystem.
Okay, lovely, thank you. Right, any questions?
Hi, Lucy from the Educational App Store. It's more just a comment, really. I've got a 9-year-old daughter and she thinks her dyslexia is a superpower. How do I convince her that through technology she's going to be correct in school, because she finds it very difficult? And I hear very often that she's in bottom groups, even though I know she's very bright, not really achieving what she should do.
Hi there, Philip Walters, ISB Chair of Rising Stars and GL Education. I just wonder on the international side whether the panel might agree that there's a bit of a problem with the word international, because it's not, I think, terribly helpful for people who are trying to get into the international market in the first place just to think, oh, there's international, that's big, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Because you're immediately struck by the fact you can't go everywhere, you're small, it's all a bit dreadful. And so you end up sort of, you know, hunkering down and not going out there. And I think maybe it's a suggestion rather than a question. It seems to me that there are some very basic ways in which we can describe the international market and break it down that would be really helpful for small and medium-sized businesses that are looking to grow. You know, international schools, that's not really an international market. It's an adjacent market of the 2,000 British-facing schools out of the 7,000 international schools that there are more or less like private schools in the UK. That's not entirely true, but it's a bit true. So you've got them. Then you've got other ways of breaking down the whole international school market. Then you've got the whole business of other kinds of independent private schools around the world, catering to the aspiring middle classes all over the place. Then you've got state systems, some of which will have open systems, some of which will have closed systems. All I'm saying is, I think it's really unhelpful the way we talk about international. And I think it's particularly unhelpful to small companies, whether they're content-driven companies or platform-driven companies, to think about it as being this, there's UK and there's international.
It's not a related question, but I was thinking, in part brought about by thinking about your daughter's self-esteem. School improvement in terms of the hidden curriculum, the kind of things like self-esteem, collaboration, cooperation, communication, friendliness, fun, enjoyment of learning. So partly where is that in school improvement, but also what role does technology have in the hidden curriculum?
I think you are absolutely right. I think any model of school improvement that focuses purely on a standards-driven agenda, that focuses purely on very measurable things, and focuses on what sometimes we say we must just focus on learning and teaching. There's an awful lot that underpins learning and teaching. We have learner-centred practices, we have learner well-being, we have the ability of children to cooperate, collaborate in peer and collaborative learning. And it's not surprising that those things that I have just reeled off fairly glibly figure in some of the things that came to the surface very clearly in the kind of meta-analysis that we did around looking at educational efficacy over time and over jurisdictions as well. It wasn't just looking in England. So I would hope that what we would be looking at is that when schools are looking at school improvement, whether that is driven through technology or through other routes or whatever, they are not overlooking those things. But with our technologies, we can make sure that we are addressing those agenda items and not necessarily just the things that perhaps bubble to the surface most often, but the things that underpin those as well, so that we're actually looking in a deep way at school improvement and not just a chasing standards from year to year model.
I'd like to think that that were true, but at the end of the day, if it's not on the school's improvement plan, even though, yes, it should be, and we could argue it should be, if it's not there, they're not going to spend money on it. That's the truth of it. We'd like to build awareness of the importance of things like resilience and character and growth mindset and all of these kinds of things which are popular. But unless they're there on the school improvement plan, they're not going to spend money on it. International, I think I'm going to blow Bisa's trumpet here, because I know as a small, growing, medium-sized business, you know, Bisa has certainly provided Rising Stars with a huge amount of support when it comes to dissecting the international market, which is, you know, international is a huge place. Where do you start? Sort of identifying those territories that might be most appropriate and directing your time and your effort on particular countries rather than trying to be all things to all.
It's spot on what like Andrea said. If it's not on the school improvement plan, I always think of it as like it's all comes down to culture and leadership from right from the top. And if it's really, really important, then these sort of things get put on the school improvement plan. And sometimes it's not all about results. I've been in schools where it stems right from the top. The headship, the leadership absolutely cares about, really caring about the well-being of the kids. Are they happy? They don't want to just see learning objectives on the board. They want to see, is there the smiles? That stuff really matters. And I see the same in businesses as well. You get some businesses that just care about profit. And you get some businesses where everyone's just a number. And some people that actually, they will forego performance for culture within the company. So I think it's something that we shouldn't. There's a great saying, you know, culture eats breakfast for strategy. You know, I absolutely believe in that, but that's something I think should be really, really important within schools, and it's not. Going back to Philip's point, I agree. You know, we learn many lessons because we tried to do the conquer the USA like the Beatles with no cash, and it just didn't work. And it's about, you know, the things that we learned was, even though we had interest in the US, but the buying cycles were so, you know, back-ended that you needed to build a ton of pipeline. And hiring people in the US is not the same as hiring people in the UK. You can't just give people Oyster cards. It's very, very expensive and very, very quickly. You know, there's many ways of doing markets like the USA, but going back to focus. So when I talked about our international strategy, yeah, we focus on international schools, but we're very specific in which markets we go. And organizations like BISA definitely help us. But if you're starting your business today, I would really, really think about what your objectives are for the business, whether it's a lifestyle business, whether you want to, it's a venture business, whether it's a social impact fund you want to raise money from. Really, really think about these things, but that, because that would definitely determine your outcomes. And if you can make those decisions early on, you're in a much better place. I definitely wish we did that when I was starting out.
I agree with your daughter 110%, right? Dyslexia is a superpower. I am dyslexic. I failed GCSE English 6 times. I was consistent, right? But it didn't stop me from succeeding. I think you have to focus on those small successes, whatever they are, and it will make her resilient in the long term. It's tough. I broke 3 laptops that met the wall unceremoniously because I just couldn't write an essay. I don't think that technology will replace good teaching. The person who taught me to pass my GCSE English inspired me around Shakespeare and brought it to life. Her name was Dawn Spears. I am so thankful for her. But technology can help us. In my case, I learned how a spell checker worked, as in I was trying to understand the algorithm behind it. And in doing so, that helped me to learn how to spell. At the same time, text-to-speak software that was starting to come out back in those days was something I was given by the university that would read it back to me so that I could actually hear it, and I still use it today. I even use speaking to text to save me time and to make my life a little bit easier. Having said that, the thinking skills that underpin the computing curriculum, the bit that I'm more interested in, I totally agree with Andrea's comments earlier about there's not enough technology in it, and actually I worry about the emphasis on coding, but the thinking skills in there, the computational thinking, those skills are decomposing, abstracting, generalizing, et cetera, come up all curriculum subjects. And in learning those skills at university, that is what enabled me to access the world and actually enabled me to actually start learning. So what I encourage her to do is to think about thinking skills and support her with small little steps for building confidence. And I totally agree with the gentleman about the term international schools. And the way that you broke that down, I wish I'd known that 1.5 years ago. And actually, yeah, we run a mile because we got kind of scared and cold feet at it. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Just go to Vinny quickly, as I think you said you aren't yet exporting. Does it scare the pants off you, the term international?
Absolutely.
Or kind of how would you approach it?
Absolutely. It scares me to death. It's just such a huge market. I wouldn't even know where to start. I'd probably feel a bit relaxed in a similar market. So again, as I mentioned, Australia would be perfect. I wouldn't want to go anywhere else. The US just seems like a very scary concept. It's way too big. I've been to EdTech conferences there, and they are nothing like that. They are absolutely huge, and that's just one. And they have these in every state and every district. And again, as Naimish mentioned, selling out there is very different. You've got the districts, you've got different cycles. It's different in every country, and that just scares me to death. So I'm going to stick to the UK for now. Lucy, just to mention, I'm dyslexic too. I hate technology. It's absolutely awful. But what I do have on my screen is I have a filter, so I can actually read better in pink. And as I see this right now, all the words are moving around and it's awful, but I think it's habit and it's persistence. I had an awful time at school and I moaned the hell out of my teachers, and that's how I pretty much got what I wanted. So if your child is not getting the technology that they need, you have to complain. You have to keep on complaining, because sometimes those teachers just don't have enough time to focus on that one child. But if you keep on doing it and you are persistent, you will get through and they will listen to you eventually. Unfortunately, that is my advice. You know, I wish it was a better way that we could focus on that individual child, but there's just not enough resources in a school.
Thank you. And you need to talk to our international manager, William, so that it's less scary. But we'll talk about international later. One final question from me then, sort of very briefly, each of you, before we finish up. If you had, you know, a Willy Wonka golden ticket gift to a school to help them, you know EdTech works, but to help them benefit and introduce technology into their school, what would the golden ticket, what problem would it solve? So what's the one biggest problem you would give them a golden ticket to solve?
Giving away plans? No, not quite. But I think technology has a huge role to play in teacher professional development. Massive. Sending teachers out to sit in a room for a day, maybe sitting listening to someone for an hour in the morning, an hour in the afternoon with a nice lunch in the middle is all very nice. Most of it's forgotten by the time they get back to school the next day. And I think there's something around ongoing professional development and what technology can do to enhance that.
I don't have to think because I agree with her. it was exactly what I'd written down in my notes if this came up, actually, was I think there is something huge around technology enabling ongoing teacher professional development that is collaborative and that is allowing teachers to access resources and research, etc. So, yeah, totally agree.
I think all I would say is that there's got to be incentives for teachers to complete that professional development. I think we still have some way to go as ed tech to support that effectively, especially with how long it takes to design online courses. So the research suggests that it takes 6 hours to plan every 1 hour of CPD. From my experience, you could spend at least another 3 hours on top of that per hour when you're trying to then convert it into an online platform to use, because you've kind of got to plan for every eventuality and you're quite limited on what you can do. And the interaction can be more difficult, especially if somebody's engaging with it online whilst doing the ironing or, you know, cooking the dinner or whatever.
Thank you. Vinny.
So I'll just give you a story. I went into a school and I was discussing EdTech with them. And about half an hour later, one of the deputy head teachers said, "What do you actually mean by EdTech?" This is a term that teachers and schools don't use enough as much as we do in the industry. So you actually do come across senior leadership teams as well as teachers who don't actually know what EdTech means. So I think starting from the beginning and actually making sure that everybody in schools knows what education technology is and how much it can actually help them. And I think that would give them that little bit of motivation to actually go out and find out more and to actually learn that technology, rather than think that this is something that is being forced for us to use in our school, even though we do not like it. So I think, again, it's a mindset change and it's teaching them about how EdTech can actually help them.
Thank you. We have reached the end of the evening, but before we finish, I'd just like to say thank you so much. I think we should all thank our panel for sparing the time and giving such inspirational comments and thoughts to us this evening. So thank you very much.
This week's episode. Thanks for listening in. If you've been working through the ASU GSV Summit series and enjoying it, we are back with a series next week on the 10th of September, looking at efficacy and impact with the Jefferson Education Accelerator, among others. If you like the sound of the EdTech podcast, we'd be immensely grateful if you could drop us a quick review on iTunes or wherever you may be listening in. And finally, don't forget to sign up to our newsletter to find out about our upcoming meetup drinks, cool jobs currently circulating, and other announcements. Check all of that out at www.theedtechpodcast.com, where you can also check out our events calendar and the EdTech Podcast Book Club. This week, I've been enjoying all the various essays in the EduShifts book. Thanks, guys. Send us your feedback on Twitter at podcastedtech, join us on Facebook, and see you next time.